Student Transportation of America has an immediate need for a safety-minded fleet maintenance mechanic to join our pros at our McCungie location. 5 years experience with general maintenance and engines required, along with a Class B CDL license, ASC certifications preferred. This is a full-time position with benefits. Apply online today at stacareers.com. That's stacareers.com. Or give our McCungie office a call at 610-421-6039.
November 10th, 1985. The hunters out in the woods at Bear Brook State Park in Northtown, Pennsylvania. As he searches for his prey, he notices a 55-gallon drum lying on his side and goes to investigate. Noticing what looks like a package is wrapped in plastic, he looks a little further and stops. There's what appears to be a human skull inside. Later, after the police arrive, there will be an autopsy where it is discovered that there are two victims inside the barrel. A woman, aged 22 to 33, and a young girl, aged between 8 and 10. They will be buried in a local cemetery under an epitaph which reads, "Here lies the mortal remains known only to God of a woman aged 23 to 33 and a girl child aged 8 to 10. Their slain bodies were found on November 10, 1985 in Bear Brook State Park. May their souls find peace in God's loving care." And although the police determined that the victims have been beaten about the head with some blunt object, they have no idea who has done it, and will not know for well over 30 years. When an enigmatic drifter goes by the name of Bob Evans is arrested for an unrelated murder in California. It won't be until after Evans' death in 2010 that his links to the murder will be discovered. Hello once again and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten, and I'd like to thank you again for joining me. I know this week's trailer was kind of disambiguous, but we are going to be looking at serial killer Terry Rasmussen this week, as well as his connection to the Bear Brook murders. For those who are unfamiliar with Rasmussen, don't worry, we will get into him shortly. Before we do that, however, I have my normal plugs. If you would like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter at Author Totten. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Ian Totten Author. On Facebook, there is a Deathcast page associated with my author page. If you would like to help support their show, there's a number of ways you can do it. We have a Patreon page at Ian Totten Author, as well as a PayPal and Venmo at Ian Totten if you want to make a one-time donation and help to the production of this show. You can also go to your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. Believe it or not, they really do help with the show. The more 5-star reviews a show has, the higher up the rankings it gets, and the more likely it is to be recommended to other listeners by that podcast app's algorithms. All right, now that the plugs are out of the way. Get yourself something to drink. Sit back, relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. All right, so as I said, we're going to be looking at Terry Rasmussen today. Before we get into that, however, the most infamous part of his very mysterious case is what became known as the Bear Brook murders. As I stated in the preview, two bodies were found inside a metal 55-gallon drum near Bear Brook State Park in 1985, and investigators really didn't have a whole lot to go on. The one body was thought to be between the age of 23 to 33, and she possibly had curly brown hair and was between 5'2" and 5'7" in height. They did note, however, that the adult female had significant dental work, including multiple fillings and 3 extractions. While the little girl who was found was thought to be between 5 to 10 years old, showed symptoms of pneumonia, had a crooked front tooth, a space between her top teeth, 2 earrings in each ear, and was between 4'3" and 4'6" tall. Her hair was thought to be wavy and light brown, and this child had no dental fillings. Now, the case went cold for years, almost 25 years, in fact, at which point it was turned over to another deputy in Allentown who went back to the site where the bodies had been found, and lo and behold, he found another 55-gallon drum really close to where the original one had been found. In fact, it was pretty much quickly established that that barrel had been there at the time the original one was found, but that the police who had done the original investigation hadn't broadened their search parameters wide enough in order to encounter it. Now, inside of this barrel, they found 2 other bodies. These were the bodies of 2 young girls. These were found on May 9th, 2000. Like the original 2 victims, it was found that the 2 girls had died from blunt force trauma. The case was somewhat heavily publicized in the area. I've seen a few different reports saying that it was publicized throughout the United States, although I did not become aware of this case until a few years ago. I do know that it was also publicized in parts of Canada as they sought to try and identify any of the victims. And the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children did do a number of facial reconstructions in an effort to track down children were. In 2004, the police announced that they had done a DNA profile on the victims and learned through mitochondrial DNA that the woman and the oldest and youngest girls were maternally related. That meant that the woman could have been either their mother, aunt, or older sister. And it wouldn't be until 2015 that it was determined that the woman was actually the mother of 2 of the girls. They found that the mother and her 2 children had lived in the northeastern United States from between 2 weeks to 3 months before their deaths. And they also found that they had been living in the area where the bodies were found. I'm not an expert on DNA, nor do I claim to, but I have to figure that they were able to do this by what enzymes were in their bodies versus the other types of enzymes that were in people who had grown up there their entire lives. they ran advanced forensic testing that showed that the middle girl, who was aged between 2 to 4 years old, had probably spent most of her childhood either the upper northeast or upper midwest, with a possibility that she had been in Wisconsin. But this was changed later in 2019 when the police said that the child was most likely originally from Arizona, Texas, California, or Oregon. But they did clarify by saying that other areas could not be discounted as being the origin of the child. January of 2017, it was announced by the police that Denise Bearden, who had been missing since 1981, was connected to the murders, and that this woman, Denise, had disappeared from Manchester, New Hampshire, along with her young daughter and then-boyfriend, Robert Bob Evans. This is one of the odd twists in this case, that Bearden was not reported missing until 2016. Which, if you're good at math, that's like roughly 36 years, something around that. So her family didn't report this woman missing for close to 40 years, and then suddenly her daughter was found alive and well in California. And the reason stated that the mother and the daughter were never listed as missing by the family is that they had gone to see them the day after Thanksgiving, only to find that they had suddenly fled the town, and the family suspected this was probably due to not wanting to face financial hardships of any type. But again, still, the entire situation is just really, really odd. And it makes me wonder if it's just not been released, but maybe there was a split between Denise and her family, if maybe drugs or something else illicit was involved, that they decided not to go looking for her. At any rate, the National Center for Missing and Exploiting Children stated that the unidentified man, who was only known at that point by the alias Robert Evans, was found through DNA to be the father of the middle child, who was found in New Hampshire. And this middle child was not related to any of the other victims. Now, Denise's daughter, who we're going to call Lisa, had been abandoned at a campground in California years earlier, and through this they were able eventually to figure out that Denise was not one of the bodies inside the barrel. They also stated that Bob Evans was considered a suspect in the murders. And they really didn't know a whole lot about who this Bob Evans was beyond the fact that he had died in December of 2010 after having been convicted and sentenced for the 2002 murder and dismemberment of his wife, Eunsoon Jun, who was a chemist in California. In June of 2017, the police released a video of Evans being interviewed, and they did this in order to try and learn his true identity. It wouldn't be until 2 months later that Bob Evans' real identity was learned. This was done when a swab from one of his sons, from what is believed to have been his first marriage, identified him as Terrence Peter Rasmussen, also known as Terry Rasmussen. But even then, the police didn't know a whole lot about the guy. It seemed as though he, you know, really didn't exist. They had to do a whole lot of digging in order to find out Rasmussen's story and see how all the pieces of this puzzle fit together. So at this point, we are going to dive into Peter Rasmussen, how he came to end up in prison for a murder, and then go through everything that was involved after that to get us to where we are today with this still ongoing case. Terrence Pedar, that's P-E-D-A-R, Rasmussen was born December 23, 1943 in Denver, Colorado. In July of 1958, his family relocated to Phoenix, Arizona. Rasmussen dropped out of high school after his sophomore year, and in April of 1961, he enlisted in the United States Navy, only to be discharged in July of 1967. There's not a whole lot known about these years of his life, at least not that I could find. After being discharged from the Navy, he moved to Hawaii, where he worked at his family's shoe store. On July 20th of 1968, he married his first wife, whose name has not been publicly released. In 1969, he moved his family back to Phoenix, Arizona, and he twin daughters were born. At this point, Rasmussen worked for a guy named Otto as an electrician. In 1970, he moved the family to Redwood City, California, and he worked as an electrician in Palo Alto. Also in 1970, a son was born to the family, and presumably this is the son that gave DNA to the police at a later date, which was able to identify Bob Evans as Rasmussen. In 1972, the family had another child born, this one a daughter. Now, in 1972, Rasmussen and his wife temporarily separate, only to get back together, so that in 1973 they can move back to Phoenix, where he again works as an electrician for Otto. He also worked in a shoe shop at this point. In April of that year, Rasmussen was arrested for aggravated assault. And there's conflicting reports on this. Some say that his wife and children left him after this aggravated assault, while others state that his family did not leave until he was arrested for aggravated assault again in 1975. Regardless, the wife left with the kids somewhere in between this period, and I've seen a couple different reports that stated that she left because he was a violent and abusive man, but I have only seen this in a couple places, nothing to confirm it. And most of this information is coming from the New Hampshire Department of Justice website, as they seem to have the most concise timeline of Rasmussen's life. In December of 1974, he arrived unexpectedly to visit his wife and children in Payson, Arizona. He was accompanied by an unidentified female. He told his family that he was living in Ingleside, Texas at the Casa del Rey Apartments. This was the last time his family ever saw Rasmussen. And everything is quiet in his world until 1978, when at some point during the year, he he contacts a friend in Arizona and asks them for money, and he stated that he was working on an oil rig in Texas. It is known that in June of 78, he was working for Brown and Root Company in Houston, and he quit that job to work elsewhere. September 28th of 1978, Rasmussen's divorce was finalized. However, his whereabouts are unknown. And it's at this point that another character enters our story. Marlise Elizabeth Honeychurch, who was born in Connecticut on January 28, 1954, she was the second oldest of five children. Now, Honeychurch, eventually her parents get divorced, with the mother moving to California with her three youngest children. Honeychurch and her older sister stayed with their father in Connecticut. Honeychurch would end up moving to California in 1969 when she was 15 years old. She was living in Lakewood, California, and was going by the last name of Salomon. In June of 1971, Honeychurch ended up getting married in Las Vegas, Nevada, with a child, Mary Elizabeth Vaughn, being born December 6th of that year. Over the next few years, Honeychurch lives in a couple different areas in location with her husband. Before 1972, June of that year, the family moves back to Stamford, Connecticut to live with her father. It should be noted her husband enlisted in the Navy somewhere around this point, and they ended up moving in 1973 to Fall River, Massachusetts. In July of that year, Honeychurch's husband and daughter moved to Lakewood, California. And it seems at this point that the couple has broken up. Her whereabouts are unknown until some point in the summer of that year, when she herself travels to Lakewood to take custody of her daughter when the husband is not present. In February of 74, she and her husband's divorce is finalized, and Honeychurch is awarded custody of her daughter Marie. She marries her second husband in Los Angeles, California later that year. And the family spends the next few years bouncing around to different areas of the state after this.
Student Transportation of America has an immediate need for a safety-minded fleet maintenance mechanic to join our pros at our McCungee location. 5 years experience with general maintenance and engines required, along with a Class B CDL license, ASC certifications preferred. This is a full-time position with benefits. Apply online today at stacareers.com. That's stacareers.com. Or give our McCungee office a call at 610-421-6039.
August of 1976, Marie's father, that'd be Honeychurch's first husband, sees the two of them for the final time in Hawaii Gardens, California. In 1977, Honeychurch's second daughter, Sarah Lynn McWaters, is born. And the following year, Honeychurch separates from Sarah's father. And eventually, Honeychurch's second husband is given custody of Sarah, with Honeychurch gaining reasonable visitation rights. However, Sarah's father ends up developing a new relationship with a woman, and after this, Sarah is not seen in the company of her father again, and it is believed that she is with Honeychurch. Now, in November of 1978, Honeychurch introduces her family to her new boyfriend on Thanksgiving in La Puente, California. Her boyfriend is, as you guessed, Terry Rasmussen, who goes by his real name, and it's the only time that he ever interacts with her family. The family did not like Rasmussen almost from the outset, and he ends up getting into an argument with her family, and they leave. The family never sees Honeycutt again after this. In 1978-79, Rasmussen pops up in New Hampshire as Bob Evans, where he works as the head electrician at the Wambach Mills, which is in Manchester, New Hampshire. Now, in January of 1980, a woman by the name of Elizabeth Evans, who has never been identified or located, signs a certified letter in Manchester, New Hampshire, where Rasmussen is living. He's arrested in February of that year as Robert T. Evans for issuing a bad check on December 21st, 1979. Again, Elizabeth is listed as his wife. In May, he's arrested for theft of services. Apparently, Rasmussen had been stealing electrical from a nearby building and diverting it to his family's house. Once again, his wife is listed as Elizabeth Evans. In October of that year, this is 1980, he was arrested again for diverting electrical current, same charge as last time. However, this time there is no spouse listed on his arrest report. Now, in 1981, he began dating Denise Bearden in Manchester, and shortly after Thanksgiving, I've seen a couple different things. Some say right after Thanksgiving, some say a few days after. Regardless, Denise and her 6-month-old daughter go missing. And it's speculated that Rasmussen killed Denise somewhere in California, but her body has never been found. This is the woman who I talked about earlier who was not listed as missing until the 2000s, something like 36 years later. What is known, though, however, is that Rasmussen, in his travels, remained in possession of Bearden's daughter, who he called Lisa, and that he posed as her father. Now, all of this information that I'm giving you now came out from a retired detective in California who did some digging after she was stunned when Rasmussen pled guilty to murder, and I'll get to that. By 1985, Rasmussen was going under the name of Curtis Kimball, and he had lived in a number of different states, including Virginia, Ohio, all over the place. And he had Lisa in tow with him. He was arrested in Cypress, California, after having a car accident. He had Lisa with him in this instance, and he was charged with a DUI and endangering the welfare of a child. However, he failed to appear in court on these charges, and a warrant was issued for his arrest. By January of 1986, he was living with Lisa in an RV park in Scotts Valley, California, where he was living under the name of Gordon Jensen and working as a handyman. He befriended Richard and Catherine Decker, who were an older couple that lived in the park, and they agreed to help care for Lisa. Now, apparently this older couple had concerns for the little girl's well-being, and eventually some sort of deal was struck between them, wherein Rasmussen would give the girl to them in order that their daughter could adopt her. Now, the Deckers took Lisa with them to San Bernardino where their daughter lived. But they ended up calling police after Lisa told them that she had been abused by the man posing as her father. At this point, the Deckers really wanted to finalize the adoption in order to keep the child from him. When they went to do this, however, they found that Rasmussen had fled the RV park, and police later connected Gordon Jensen to the identity of Curtis Kimball from the previous DUI charge that he'd had, after which they issued an arrest warrant. He wouldn't be seen again until November of 1988, when Rasmussen was pulled over in San Luis Obispo, California, and he was driving under the name of Jerry Mockerman in a vehicle that had been stolen from Preston, Idaho. Somehow he was able to wiggle out of this. However, in March of 1989, he was arrested in California again on warrants for child abandonment and sentenced to 3 years in prison. Now, he wouldn't serve his entire sentence, as in October of 1990, he was paroled, after which point he vanished, and there are no records of where Rasmussen went or what he did for almost a decade, until June of 1998, when he was pulled over under name of Lawrence William Banner and was cited for not having insurance or a driver's license. Now, in December of 1999, chemist Eunsoon Jun, who was 42, of Richmond, California, introduces her boyfriend, going under the name of Larry Vanner, to her family. And from everything that I have read, it seems that Eunsoon Jun was a very sweet, loving woman, and that for some reason she was absolutely smitten by Rasmussen. Now, the two of them eventually ended up getting married in June's backyard, although this was not legal in the state of California. Rasmussen was living in June's home with her by June 2002, at which point June went missing, and I do know that a friend of hers had tried to make contact a number of times with her, only for Rasmussen to say that she was out of the area visiting family, and he gave a couple of other different reasons as to why she wasn't around. Eventually, this friend became concerned enough that she contacted the police and reported her as missing. And it wasn't until September of that year that Rasmussen, under the name of Larry Vanner, was brought in for questioning. He voluntarily gave his fingerprints, and I've read a couple things that he wasn't realizing that they have what is called live scan, which is where they take your fingerprints and they can come back in minutes. He was apparently figuring that it would be some time before the fingerprints came out, and he would be long gone by the time they got them. However, the fingerprints came back pretty quick as a match to Curtis Kimball, who was wanted for violating his parole in Lisa's abandonment, and Rasmussen was arrested. Now, while he was in police custody, the police continued to search June's home in Richmond. And eventually, one of the officers went down into the basement and saw a large pile of kitty litter sitting there. And they thought that this was suspicious looking, so they began poking around. And lo and behold, the body of Eunsoon Jun was found underneath the kitty litter. She had been murdered and hacked up, her body mummified by the cat litter. In June of 2003, Rasmussen, still under the name of Curtis Kimball, announced during a pre-trial hearing that he wanted to plead guilty to murder, which, you know, that pretty much just says he knew he was caught at this point, and either he was tired of running, or, you know, he knew, you know, that he wasn't getting out of this one. So he ends up getting 15 years to life in prison. Now, while the police have him in custody, the homicide detective, whose name is Roxanne Grunheide, starts looking into Rasmussen. There was something about him and his number of aliases that she found to be unsettling. And that was how she found out about the case of Lisa. Now, if you'll remember, Lisa was the young girl that Rasmussen had sexually abused and then abandoned in 1985. Now, it wasn't until 2013 that another detective, Peter Headley of the San Bernardino County, got Lisa's case. And he was able to convince Lisa to sign up for some of these ancestry databases where they use your DNA to link you to people. And they got a couple hits back for distant cousins, but it wasn't until they reached out to a company called DNA Adoption, which helps adoptees identify birth families through their DNA matches, that the case really started moving forward. Now, after months of this, they eventually were able to find a man by the name of Armand Budin, who was in New Hampshire. And Budin was Denise's father. And eventually it was determined that Lisa was, in fact, Dawn Budin, who had not been seen since she was 5 months old in 1981. Armed with this information, the investigators in New Hampshire began looking at the bodies in the barrels case again, as they knew that they had a Bob Evans on record as having lived in the area, and this person had spent a lot of time around that property, as he did basic handyman services as well as electrical for a store that was located adjacent to the property. And what came out of this DNA testing, much to their surprise, was that Bob Evans was the father of the middle child that was found. Although he had no known connection at that point to the other three victims. Now, unfortunately, Rasmussen had died in December of 2010 at the state prison in Susanville, California, from a combination of pulmonary emphysema, pneumonia, and lung cancer. So they had nowhere they could look as far as that goes. However, they took his DNA and were able to link him to the Rasmussen family. Now, in October of 2008, a reporter for our New Hampshire Public Radio by the name of Jason Moon does a 7-episode podcast on the Bear Brook murders. This is actually how I found out about this case. He does a much, much more extensive deep dive on the Bear Brook murders and the subsequent developments. Well, an amateur sleuth by the name of Rebecca Heath listens to the podcast, and she starts scouring online message boards of relatives looking for missing family members. At the same time that she's doing this, a DNA profiler is scouring records, and they eventually are able to identify the older woman and the two girls who are found in the barrels. The bodies are eventually confirmed on June 6, 2019, as having belonged to Marlise Honeychurch and her two children, Marie Vaughn and Sarah McWaters. And it's really amazing to see how Rasmussen being convicted of murder led to Lisa being identified as Dawn Boudet, and that this whole chain of events eventually led to the identification of the bodies in New Hampshire, which is on the entire other side of the country from where Lisa had been abandoned. And through all of this, they were able to figure out that Bob Evans, who had God knows how many aliases, was not only the father of one of the victims, but had known ties to the three others, and that because of this, they were, in essence, able to close these decade-long cold cases. But there's other cases that Rasmussen is suspected in as well. Two of them from Manchester, New Hampshire. One of them was 14-year-old Laureen Ron, who disappeared in April of 1980. And the other was from June of 1980, and that was 25-year-old Denise Denault, who coincidentally lived on the same street as Rasmussen. Searches have been done regarding Denault's former property. However, there has been no evidentiary connection between Denault and Rasmussen. Another avenue that they are investigating involves Lisa again, who was interviewed by police and asked if she had any other relatives, or siblings rather, and Lisa went on to state that she did have other siblings, but they died from eating grass mushrooms when they were out camping, which has naturally led police to believe that that Rasmussen had killed them as well. The last one that they are looking at that we're aware of comes from San Joaquin County in California, and that's called the San Joaquin Jane Doe. She was found in 1995 by a scavenger inside a refrigerator which had been dumped into a canal. She had died from blunt force trauma. She's been identified as possibly having strawberry blonde hair. She was 29 to 41 years old, between 5'5" and 5'7", weighing 110 to 130 pounds. She was inside a sleeping bag wrapped in a quilt. She had manicured nails and jewelry, including a wedding ring. She also possibly wore a charm bracelet, as remnants of a leather band were located in her pocket. She wore a blue sweatshirt, denim shorts, a t-shirt, bra, knee-high socks with various colors, and expensive boots. Police speculate that she came from elsewhere in the state and was dumped there, along with the refrigerator, by Rasmussen. Now, things are still happening in this case. In February of last year, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children released another rendering of the only unidentified victim in the Barrel Murders, the one that is related to Rasmussen. Just today, January 21st, police in Louisiana announced that new genealogy research shows that the unidentified victim found in the barrels might have relatives from Pearl River County, Mississippi, and it's the belief that the girl and her biological mother are descendants of one of two men, both of whom were born in the mid-1800s. I'm gonna post links to articles about this particular break in the case, as who knows, maybe somebody out there who listens to this show could possibly have been related to these two individuals and can help further identify this unidentified victim. At any rate, that is the Death Cast for this week. I hope you enjoyed my look at the life and crimes of Terry Rasmussen. This is a very unique and interesting case with all its convoluted twists and turns. It's almost like something out of a cheap dime store novel. The way this man moved around the country, the crimes he committed, the whole thing. And you can find out more about him by, if you're any of the places you find podcasts, you just look for the Bear Brook Murders and look for the series by the New Hampshire Public Radio. It's one of those podcasts I can't recommend highly enough. There are so many facets of this case that are so fascinating, and so many small little rabbit holes and technical details that are just too deep for me to dive into. I can't recommend it enough. Until next week, stay safe and stay morbid.
Student Transportation of America has an immediate need for a safety-minded fleet maintenance mechanic to join our pros at our McCungee location. 5 years experience with general maintenance and engines required, along with a Class B CDL license, ASC certifications preferred. This is a full-time position with benefits. Apply online today at stacareers.com. That's stacareers.com. Or give our McCungee office a call at 610-421-6039.
Hey there, it's Uncle Sam and Buddy here to tell you that Phillipsburg Easton Honda is the lease return destination. We want you to bring your lease to Phillipsburg Easton Honda because we're giving you $500 for it. Yes, regardless of where you originally lease your vehicle from, the year, the make, or model, at Phillipsburg Easton Honda, we want it now. Even if you don't lease your next vehicle from us, we'll still pay you just for returning your lease to us. Yes, that's $500 right on the spot, right in your pocket. No obligations. But wait, that's not all. At Phillipsburg Easton Honda, we'll also handle the entire lease return process. That's right. At Phillipsburg Easton Honda, we'll waive any remaining payments, lease end charges, wear and tear, and over mileage. Phillipsburg Easton Honda is the $500 lease return destination, and we want you to get cash for returning your lease to us. Ready to get paid just for returning your vehicle? Then visit pehonda.com/lease today. Buddy always says yes.